So what effect will the death of the Islamic State group leader have on President Donald Trump's support in the US, especially among his core supporters? Trump won 81% of the white evangelical vote in 2016, despite a personal history and lifestyle that not even he would call pious. So what binds evangelicals so tightly to Donald Trump? What keeps them on side? John Fear is a history professor at Messiah College in Pennsylvania and the author of a new book, Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Donald Trump. He's one of the 19% of evangelicals who did not support Trump. So his book is part history and part cry from the heart about where his Christian tradition is heading.
In the United States, in the election of 2016, 81% of white evangelical Christians self-identified as people who are either evangelical or people who said they were born again Christians voted for Donald Trump. I am an evangelical Christian myself. I did not vote for Trump in 2019. And I actually think, as I wrote in my book, that it's bad for Christians, the church, as well as the nation. So I dedicate the book to all of those fellow anti-Trumpers who claim the label evangelical or something similar to that label and did not vote for Donald Trump.
John, one of the points you make about Trump and his appeal to that 81% of white evangelicals is that he's quote-unquote a strong man. How do you think his killing of the Islamic State leader al-Baghdadi will affect his standing with those white evangelicals?
I think it will go a long way towards securing their support in the 2020 presidential election. In many ways, evangelicals are kind of hypocrites on this. They were sort of neutral at best, didn't say much when Barack Obama killed bin Laden, but now they're cheering this recent killing. Because, of course, one of the fears that evangelicals have is this threat of terrorism. And most Americans have this threat of terrorism, right? Any normal, rational person would. But for evangelicals, this very much is not only tied into Muslim terrorists, but sort of all Muslims. They fear the kind of Christian decline of their nation. So if this is going to protect the United States, but also protect Christians in the Middle East, this killing, then Trump is the kind of strong man they want to turn to protect them. It fits with the larger pattern of why they voted for him in 2016.
Yeah. I don't think, though, it would be just white evangelicals who would be relieved at the death of al-Baghdadi, but you do make a point in your book that there's a certain image that Trump has used to project himself to white evangelicals, and this killing will affirm it.
Absolutely. One of the reasons why white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump in 2016 instead of some of the more conservative candidates who had more sort of Christian right credentials, people like Ted Cruz or Ben Carson or Marco Rubio, is because they believed Trump would fight for them. Trump would protect them, not only against terrorists, but he would protect them against all sort of Muslim invaders, outside invaders, those who were going to take away their white Christian America that they hold to so dearly.
And John, there was one particular white evangelical leader, a man called Robert Jeffries, who I think barely restrained himself from using the phrase son of a bitch. But what he was saying was something about Trump and his strength. And this is why he was throwing his weight behind him.
Right. Robert Jeffress is the pastor of a very large church in Dallas, First Baptist Church of Dallas. He was an early supporter of Trump in the political primaries. And he said, you know, I don't care that this man is an adulterer. I don't care that he sleeps with porn stars. I don't care what his moral character is. I want the best son of a gun, right, to fight for me against the forces of secularization, the forces of outside influence, whether it be from Muslims or Mexicans or whoever is going to water down white Christian America. So, I mean, this historically, evangelicals have always turned to these political strongmen, American evangelicals, to try to help them to defend the moral and social issues that they hold dear. So I think this is just one extreme example of that.
Given the accumulated scandals of Donald Trump just in the last 3 years, not even considering those in his life before the presidency, is there any sign of Trump's support weakening among the 81% of white evangelicals?
I don't think the erosion is going to be significant at all. I think you can expect in 2020, again, I'm a historian, I'm not a prophet, but I think you can expect most evangelicals to rally around Trump again in 2020. We did see a little dent in the armor, if you will, when Trump pulled out of Syria and abandoned the Kurdish Christians in that region. But Trump quickly fixed that by promising $50 million in humanitarian aid. He even had Franklin Graham, the son of the evangelist Billy Graham, saying, you know, changing his mind. I now respect Trump's decision. The point is that American evangelicals, when they engage in politics, at least the conservative variety of American evangelicals, operate in politics with a hierarchy of moral concerns. At the top of that hierarchy is the question of abortion and the Supreme Court nominations that will try to overturn Roe versus Wade. Trump has delivered on two of those justices with the appointment of Kavanaugh and Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. Secondly, on that hierarchy is religious liberty, which is usually connected with the issue of traditional marriage. Evangelicals now are no longer trying to make a marriage between a man and a woman the law of the land, but they at least want liberty to be able to continue to express those ideas in their institutions. So if Trump were to violate or to somehow undermine those two fundamental moral questions that drive evangelicals to the polls, you might see a break with Donald Trump. But so far, he has delivered on all of these things.
And yet, John, has he really delivered in concrete terms? Because your book, Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Donald Trump, brings this out rather clearly, that yes, he did appoint two conservative Republicans to the US Supreme Court, but you say that really only just preserved a status quo. Abortion is still legal, although interestingly, abortion fell to its lowest point since 1973 under Barack Obama. Same-sex marriage is legal everywhere. What in concrete terms has he in fact given evangelicals other than holding a line?
Well, it's holding a line, and it's, dare I use this term, but for many conservative evangelicals, it's hope. It's hope for the future of their agenda. So let's take the Supreme Court nominations, right? So far, there has not been an abortion case in the United States that has made its way to the Supreme Court where Roe versus Wade is going to be challenged. The hope is that when that happens, and there are currently dozens of cases working their way up through the courts, Trump creates an opportunity now for conservative evangelicals to bring these cases forward. And someday when a case does get before the Supreme Court, there is a very good chance, because of the appointments of Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, that Roe v. Wade could be overturned. Now, of course, my argument is the ending of Roe v. Wade, or the overturning of Roe v. Wade, which I think could be very likely, is not going to in any way end abortions, and that evangelicals should be thinking much more creatively. The fact that they rely completely on the Supreme Court to reduce the number of abortions or end abortion is what puts them into bed, if you will, with this strong man, Trump. Religious liberty, Trump has kind of, at least for Christians to be able to, Little Sisters of the Poor, Christian institutions, churches, he's fought to keep their right to uphold their views of marriage and continue to get their tax-exempt status and government financial aid for students at Christian colleges and so forth. So as much as he claims that he's done this, he's done nothing to change the law there. The Johnson Amendment, which is the amendment to the U.S. tax code that forbids churches to endorse political candidates. Trump likes to say that he changed the Johnson Amendment, but he technically hasn't.
Yeah, I think he just made a symbolic statement about it, saying no one should censor you in the pulpit or something.
Exactly. It's much more of a symbolic statement, again, in the hopes that someday this will be removed from the tax code. So I think what Trump does is kind of, in the minds of conservative evangelicals, sets the wheels churning, and it allows them to kind of think now that possibly we may be able to quote unquote win back our country, because we have this man who wants to so-called make America great again, right? Yeah. And return us to some golden age, which I argue may have never even existed in the first place.
One of the really interesting questions that comes through very powerfully in your book is also a pretty simple one, and that is, was Donald Trump the last resort? Was he the least worst choice for white evangelicals? Or was he in some way the answer to their prayers?
It depends which evangelical you talk to. It actually depends which of the 81% you talk to. One of the things I've learned going around the country speaking about the book and doing shows like this and talking to evangelicals is that that 81% who voted for Trump, they have some diversity as well within. There are some evangelicals who just despised Hillary Clinton so much and decided Trump, because of his views on abortion and religious liberty, is really the only option. So yeah, we don't like Trump. We don't like the character flaws. We don't like the immorality. We don't like the tweets. We don't like all of these things that now we know embodies the kind of Trump brand of politics. But at least he's not Hillary Clinton. Now, there's another group within that 81%, and it's hard to say who held the majority, that really do believe in this providential understanding of the world in which God is appointing Donald Trump, to quote the Old Testament book of Esther, quote unquote, for such a time as this. In other words, America is in trouble. Millions of babies are dying because of abortion. Christians are losing their religious liberty. We have this influx of foreigners, both from the Middle East and from south of the border. And Donald Trump has been raised up by God, appointed by God, to bring America, God's chosen people, going all the way back to this idea of America as a city upon a hill. God is appointing Trump for such a moment, very similar to the way in which they would say in the Old Testament, God chose King Cyrus, a pagan Persian leader who allowed the Israelites, the chosen people of God, to leave captivity and come back to the promised land. In their mind, in their worldview, God uses people that you would not expect to serve his purposes.
Didn't some of these evangelical leaders even claim to have had prophetic visions of Trump becoming president, probably a decade before he did become president?
That's right. There's a certain segment of Trump-supporting evangelicals who fall into traditional, or in some ways they're non-traditional, they're brand new. I call them independent charismatics. They believe in prophecy. A lot of them would be the ones who uphold this King Cyrus model. Matter of fact, there was one who was on television a few months ago trying to sell a special coin that had King Cyrus on one side and Donald Trump on the other. And for $45, right, you could get this coin.
Oh, yes. I knew there'd be a price tag.
Exactly. This commemorative coin. But there's history. I think there are three or four prophecies of people projecting not just that some pagan leader is going to be used by God, but actually predicting that Donald Trump would be the next president. And then once he declared his candidacy, these prophecies began to multiply. The passage in the Bible where King Cyrus is talked about as being used by God to free the Israelites from captivity is Isaiah 45. Donald Trump is the 45th president of the United States. So people are getting these prophecies saying, well, this has to be some kind of a divine purpose there.
This is the Religion and Ethics Report with Andrew West. I'm speaking today with John Fear. John is the author of a new book, Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Donald Trump. And John is professor of American history at the Messiah College in Pennsylvania. And he is a leading commentator on religion and politics in the US. John, there are tens of thousands of evangelical leaders of congregations, big and small, around the US. And I suppose I can understand the guarded, even grudging support that some gave to Trump. But it seems to me no coincidence that the evangelicals that Donald Trump, the showman, the TV star, seems to gel with most are the televangelists. This all seems showbiz, really, doesn't it?
One might say that, yes.
No, but I mean, it's a serious distinction, though, because the ones that he seems to affirm him the most are the TV evangelists who have pizzazz.
Just about every major political evangelical leader who's come out to support them also has a kind of television program, right, where they go on the air every day. They, especially those in the wing of evangelicalism known as the prosperity gospel. Now, some evangelicals would say that the prosperity gospel is heresy, but these are people who see the blessing of God coming through wealth. People like Paula White, for example, who has a massive following in the United States, goes on the television every week telling people to give money to her ministry because God will bless them if they do. Donald Trump's wealth and Donald Trump's popularity is especially attractive to this branch of American evangelicals because they see if God is blessing, as they would put it, Trump with this wealth and these hotels and these businesses and these golf courses, then somehow he must be doing something right. He must be living the kind of life that he's supposed to be living. And maybe he's even a Christian. As Paula White said, she converted Trump. Trump had a born-again experience under the ministry of Paula White. So I think there's this attraction to Trump because of his wealth and because of his sort of charisma. A lot of these supporters, especially in these charismatic wings, see Trump as an anointed person because of that.
Yeah. Didn't Paula White, this prosperity gospeler that you referred to, who interestingly does have her own hard scrabble rags-to-riches story, right, that is authentic, but didn't she also say that self-denial, especially in a material sense, was satanic?
Yes, I believe she did at some point. This is a core tenet of this kind of prosperity gospel. The other popular prosperity gospel preacher, probably even more popular than Paula White, although he stayed out of politics for the most part, is this Houston pastor named Joel Osteen, who see Christianity as totally God will bring you happiness in a kind of worldly way. God will bring you comfort. God will bring you wealth. And if that is not happening and you are suffering, you are in a situation where you have to deny yourself for some greater cause or some greater good, then certainly this is not of God, right? God is only going to bring blessing into your life. It kind of challenges the deeply held view of the sin nature of human sin that has so defined American evangelicalism for the last couple hundred years here in the United States. So absolutely. And again, you know, the fact that Trump very rarely talks about America in terms of its suspect past in relationship to, you know, its flaws about slavery, treatment of Native Americans, so forth. There's some similarities between Trump's style of politics and this kind of prosperity gospel, health and wealth prosperity gospel.
You raise the point there about slavery and race as those stains on America's history. This raises a very interesting point, John, that you look at in the book as well, and that is there are a lot of black evangelicals. The black church, I think, could be characterized in some way as evangelical with some of its core doctrines. And right, many African Americans would have some socially conservative views, but yet they will not, they steadfastly refuse to be courted by Trump if he's even made the attempt. What is that impenetrable barrier between the two of them?
Most African Americans, although they don't identify with that term, do emphasize evangelical doctrines, the born-again experience, the authority of the Bible, the need for a conversion experience. This has a long history within the African American church. But African Americans would be particularly resistant to any president that is running on a platform to make America great again. Because many African Americans, not just evangelicals, but African Americans generally, and I think many African American evangelicals would identify with their larger racial group and the history of slavery and the history of Jim Crow and race relations in the United States on this point. What Trump wants to do is to sort of take us back. No African American in the United States wants to go back They don't want to go back to the 70s. They don't want to go back to the 80s. They don't want to go back to the 1950s. They certainly don't want to go back to the 19th century. Even the most conservative evangelicals in the African American church on questions of abortion or traditional marriage would be very progressive in terms of these questions of race and racism. And what they see Trump as doing is trying to take us back to an era in which there was a great deal of injustice shown by the United States government towards people of color.
Just as we wind up here on the Religion and Ethics Report, with Andrew West speaking with John Fear, the author of the new book, Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Donald Trump. I can understand, John, how many conservative evangelicals could look past all of Donald Trump's moral failings. But the one thing that struck me as being surely insurmountable as an object for them was Donald Trump's comment that he had never, ever asked God for forgiveness for anything. Now, I would have thought this completely betrays a core part of evangelical thinking, which is the idea of the personal redemption story. Because didn't George W. Bush often tell the story about how when he was 40 years old and trying to overcome his alcoholism, he stopped his car on the side of the road and knelt down and had, and this was an experience that many evangelicals with their own failings could relate to. And yet here's Donald Trump saying, I've never asked forgiveness for anything.
You're exactly right about this. You know, we live, first of all, it's a different age from when George W. Bush did what you just described and called Jesus his favorite philosopher because he saved my soul in a debate, could testify to Billy Graham's influence on his conversion, right? All of these things would have made white evangelicals in America very pleased. That was pre-Obama. I don't think we can underestimate the way in which white evangelicals saw Barack Obama as a threat. So I think this comes down to the kind of political philosophy, if you will, that drives these evangelical Christians, or at least the way suddenly now it does. It didn't back in the 1980s, but they've changed their mind when it comes to Trump. And that is this. Robert Jeffress loves to say this, right? We are not electing a pastor in chief, they would say. We're electing a president. And yes, we disagree, although they would never come out and say this, but if pushed, they would say, yes, of course we disagree with this man saying he doesn't need forgiveness. But again, it goes back to what I said earlier in the interview. God still will use this sinner who doesn't realize he's a sinner in important ways. So that's one side. You know, there's others like Paula White who say he has confessed, he has accepted Jesus and so forth. But I think the overwhelming majority of evangelical leaders who support Trump will argue that it just doesn't matter. You know, so they've kind of changed their tune a little bit over the past 20 years. I've tried to reflect this in the book. You know, in the 1980s, it was not only, or 1990s and early 2000s, you wanted a person who's going to uphold the evangelical positions on social issues like abortion, but you also want a person of some kind of good character. What happened with Donald Trump was you had a man who didn't have the good character, but still had the social positions. And would the political playbook that the Christian right has been using all along, would it survive if there was a corrupt, immoral person who said he doesn't need forgiveness? And I think the answer is that the playbook, right, we elect the person who's going to deliver on the social issues, did survive despite the flaws of the candidate.
You mentioned Barack Obama there. The interesting thing, though, is that your friend Michael Ware, who worked for Barack Obama as his outreach director to faith communities, points out, though, that in 2008, Barack Obama got nearly 25% of the white evangelical vote. And then I think he still got 22% or 23% in 2012. Obama did make some efforts that Hillary Clinton seemed to completely forget about. So even though there was this fear of Barack Obama, he still managed to do something almost unprecedented for a 21st century Democrat, and that was get a reasonable share of the white evangelical vote.
Well, I think this was the flaw of the Hillary Clinton campaign. Hillary Clinton did not make any appeals to the white evangelical population. Barack Obama did. Barack Obama could freely speak a religious language. It was not the conservative evangelicalism of the Christian right. It was a kind of liberal Protestantism. But there was enough God language there and enough attempt to reach out to evangelicals. So at my own institution, Messiah College, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton came to speak right before the Pennsylvania primary. And at that point in 2008, Hillary was making gestures towards Christians and evangelicals. She was talking, for example, about abortion in very similar ways that her husband had talked about abortion, right? It should be safe, it should be rare, and it should be legal. We didn't see that Hillary Clinton in 2016. You know, Obama then went to this mega church out in California.
Rick Warren's church,
Saddleback Church. He tried to at least make an effort. It paid off with maybe, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 more percentage points. Certainly, he did much better among evangelicals because of that. And I do think this election in 2016 was so close. You know, I try to make the argument in the book, if Hillary would have just sort of thrown a bone to white evangelicals in her rhetoric, it could have made a big difference. I mean, white evangelicals have a very, very negative perception of the Clintons, going back to the Lewinsky scandal, going back to Hillary Clinton defending Bill's behavior, talking about a right-wing conspiracy against her husband. I say in the book, Christians are not supposed to hate, but they hate, evangelicals at least hate Hillary Clinton here in America. Yeah. So I think there was that factor as well.
Just finally, John, you say there is a much more positive and optimistic future, even for people who call themselves conservative evangelicals, and one that does not prioritize political power. What is that more optimistic future for them, if they want it?
I think the average Trump voter was 57 years old. So I don't know what the average evangelical Trump voter was, but I'm guessing it was roughly around the same age, maybe a little older. These older white evangelicals came of age during the Falwell Christian right era, Falwell Sr. of the 1980s. They learned that there was one way to do politics, right? You try to pursue political power, you try to get Supreme Court appointees, you try to elect the right president and so forth. Younger evangelicals that I see are sort of rejecting that model, some of them more outright than others. But I see young evangelicals, I spend time with them every day. I teach a lot of white evangelicals at Messiah, 18 to 22 year olds, who are no less concerned about questions that evangelicals might call life issues or family values. But they have broadened those terms to relate to just immigration policy, immigration reform, the environment, care for the poor. All of these things are part of life issues. I think they're no less pro-life on abortion than the older generation. They are much more open to the idea of gay marriage. So, and here I'm giving my own judgment on this. I am hopeful about the future of evangelicals. Many of these young people are going to perhaps even stay within the Republican Party, but I think the Republican Party is going to look very, very different in the next 20 to 40 years because of these youngsters.
Your optimism is captured, though, in a lovely phrase, and it is conditional, that is, that evangelicals be, quote, a faithful presence in their communities, not trying to exert power, but in service.
I think there are all kinds of models out there for the way evangelicals could engage culture, engage politics, but the Falwell Christian right moral majority playbook has been so powerful. The idea of being faithfully present in the places where God has placed you is not my term. It comes from the University of Virginia sociologist James Davison Hunter, who wrote a wonderful book about this. But there are other models out there, too. You see the Washington Post columnist and former speechwriter for Bush 2, Michael Gerson, making arguments that are drawing heavily from Catholic social teaching to get evangelicals to think about their responsibilities. And then you have, as well, this sort of older evangelical left, people like Jim Wallace and Ron Sider, who are trying to push young evangelicals, or all evangelicals, to think a little more beyond the simple one or two moral issues. So what's fascinating to me as a historian is that a lot of these models for evangelical political engagement have been out there now for a decade or more, in some cases 30, 40 years. But the moral majority Christian right vision of politics has been so influential that it's hard for these other views to make any kind of a dent.
Well, your book is the start of that journey. Professor John Fear is the author of Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Donald Trump. He's a professor of history at Messiah College in Pennsylvania. John, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.